for Professor Appleby, I think. Dr. Eichholz discussed what was at least an apparent dichotomy between a concept of individual self-government and that of republicanism. How do you see that informing your generation, the sons and daughters of the American War for Independence, those who were raised up with a concept of what we kind of broadly call republicanism with a small r?
Well, it's very difficult. I think John Adams said that republicanism was a word that no one knew the meaning of, and I think that I don't think there's been a great deal of improvement since Adams' time, because it seems to refer to all sorts of things. If republicanism is meant to refer to a sense of the necessity of men possessing virtue to put the public good before their own self-interest, which is one definition of republicanism, there is certainly, you certainly get echoes of that, but I think that most of the people in this generation felt that in pursuing their own interests, and they would define that very broadly, they were pursuing the interests of the community. They tended not to sharpen that difference between a liberalism of individual self-interest. I'm not answering this very well because these concepts are so murky, and so much has been said about them.
This is a quite interesting quote. And okay. In all of the searching of sources, the pursuit of happiness, one of them that seems to have been overlooked is a passage out of Lord Kames's essays on the principles of morality and natural religion, which was in all of Jefferson's reading list. And at the end, he has a hymn of praise to the Creator that observed this, and maybe it will kind of go towards your question. What various and complicated machinery is here, and regulated with what exquisite art, while man pursues happiness as his chief aim, thou bendest self-love into the social direction, thou infusest the generous principle which makes him feel for sorrows not his own, nor feels he only, but strange indeed, takes delight in rushing into foreign misery, and with pleasure goes to drop the painful tear over real or imaginary woe. Thy divine hand thus formed the connecting tie, and by sympathy linked man to man, that nothing might be solitary in thy world, but all tend to mutual association. And that association can be for reasons of faith, philanthropy, commerce, and all of that. So,
I think one of the things that why I was having difficulty with this is because the person who is a public benefactor is very much admired. Henry Clay was by far the most admired person from the people whose autobiographies I read, because he was seen as someone who cared about the public realm. But I think there's a confidence that's reflected in this that people will be drawn to this kind of public service on their own without compulsion. But I just think these concepts are too murky to do justice to the complexity of what people are thinking. And they're also working in new ways, and they're optimistic in ways that we would not be optimistic today. Popping up and down.
Hi, this is for Professor Appleby. What did you find out about your generation that might change the way we think about how Americans approached politics in the early 19th century?
Well, I think basically you're asking me, what did I find out that we didn't know before? I think that I found out, probably the most important thing I found out was that the differentiation between the North and the South started very, very early and is almost all directly or indirectly associated with slavery. David Walker is a sign that puts a damper in the South on any concern with education, with building schools, having newspapers. may existed, but in much fewer numbers. And that's just one example of the indirect ways. So I think what I found was the South very much stayed within its colonial parameters. It moved into cotton, away from tobacco in one thing or another, but it didn't change dramatically, whereas the North changed dramatically. And because the North had the press, as it were, and because it was so much more vigorous, the North was able to define the country as being like it. And this threw the South on the defensive, where they felt they hadn't changed, the North had changed, but they were increasingly defined as a region. So I would say that's probably, from an historian's point of view, the most interesting thing that I found. The other thing I would say that I found was the role of youth, which I don't know had ever been appreciated. How greatly expanded were the opportunities, and how quickly the young people took them, and how they used their ability to move on their own as a way of affirming a certain set of American values. After all, there was a great pot of values there, and they didn't all survive. And this generation certain things and braided them together into an American fabric.
Waiting for that.
This is Professor Appleby. I just had a question. You mentioned that in the colonies there were more newspapers printed than anywhere else in the world, which I think presumes a well-educated population. Can you say, were most of those papers printed in the North, or was it equally distributed throughout the colonies? What kind of educational institutions were
The figure was not about the colonies. It was 1822 was the figure when Americans had more newspaper issues than any other country in the world. The overwhelming majority of them were in the North. Ohio, before it was a state, had more printing presses than Georgia, which had been a colony since the early 18th century. So it was much more in the North than the South. The education was pretty primitive, but North and South, though again much less in the South, areas formed into districts, and they managed to get about 3 or 4 months schooling for youngsters. The goal was, of course, to get them to read and write and cipher to the rule of three. I've never known what ciphering to the rule of three is, but I guess it has something to do with arithmetic. The interesting thing about the school, because literacy becomes important, it's clearly this is a interactive effect. You have more to read, it becomes more important than you have to teach people to read, is that school teaching was the number one avenue for men and women to get away from their rural homes, because they could get jobs as school teachers, and they use it just as an avenue. They stay in it for 2 or 3 or 4 years.
I'd like to ask both speakers about an issue which has come up in our current electoral scene, particularly the interplay between religion and the state, church and state, if you will, and how the first generation, particularly after our First Amendment, gave an impetus to the separation of church and state, or the coordination of religious ideals in our early republic.
I guess you in a sense you're asking me how they conceived of the separation of church and state. Well, I think one way to approach it, this is a very complicated question, I think one way to approach it is to approach it from how they viewed their political institutions. And one of the things that I tried to get across in my brief remarks was that that one of the things they were trying to control for was the abuse of power. So that one of the things that they made very clear was that separation would be there for the national government, for the general government, as they called it, often. That application to the states, however, was far more problematic, and those battles were fought out at the state level because of their conception of what natural rights were. And I guess the best way to think about it is this. In the Declaration, it talks about the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's not that those are the only rights that people possess, that those are the only natural rights that people possess, but those may be the rights that reasonable men can confer upon and agree that when these are violated, we're going to have a revolution. Now, they were very well aware that reasonable men might disagree about what the content of natural rights are. And where is that debate going to take place? I think the revolutionary generation agreed that that debate was going to take place at the level of the states. So in their states, they argued, such as in Virginia, and as we know, Jefferson was intimately involved in that debate, would fight out what the content of those natural rights would be, and that those natural rights then would be translated into what Jefferson referred to as their civil rights. So that in the case of Virginia, there would be that separation honored. It wouldn't be until much later honored in the same way, for example, in Massachusetts, which continued to have semi-establishment. But I think overall, generally, that debate was well thought out at the state level, and the separation then did incorporate most of the other states. Now, part of your question was the implication for today. Is that what you were saying? I really don't know how to address that, so I'm going to bow out. Thank you.
Well, actually, there were a lot of battles in the early 19th century over the issue of religion, and as Hans said, much of it was at the state level, but it did get to the national level because there was a very powerful Sabbatarian movement to have laws that enforced the Sabbath. And the Sabbath was observed, that is to say, the Protestant Christian Sabbath was observed through local custom and through law, and you didn't have a transportation system that moved on Sunday. Then the Erie Canal came into existence, and the flow of water did not stop on Sunday. And this became a huge controversy of should they allow boats to go down the Erie Canal. And there was an effort to get the other thing is that getting the mail on Sunday was extremely important, just as it was getting it every day, and there was a feeling that it was keeping particularly men away from church, so they wanted to get the mails to stop on Sunday. And there was a real pressure to do this. Finally, the person that got to save the day in Congress said that it would be making a religious statement to stop the delivery of mail on Sunday because not all religions celebrated the Sabbath on the same day. Boy, this is really going around to find the logical way of getting out of this. So these there were lots of issues that because of the power of religion, because these religious revivals, as I suggested, turned everyone into these religious entrepreneurs in the sense of wanting to do something to take this zeal and bring it to the whole country. So I would say the history of America has seen a waxing and waning of this issue, and that wall of separation, of course, was something that Jefferson said in a letter they wrote to the Danbury Baptists about declaring a day of Thanksgiving, but it's never been a part of the Constitution, and I don't think it's invoked to maintain a distinction, but it is not a very effective wall, and I think that this is an issue that each generation has to debate in its own terms and in ways that is meaningful to them. There's a minimum there in the First Amendment, which is the federal government cannot establish any religion. But beyond that, I think there's going to be a constant struggle over this.
Question for Joyce Appleby. Just out of curiosity, at the time, the period of your study, what major countries outside of the United States and outside of the Americas had a substantial amount of slavery or laws that supported slavery?
Well, the British had slaves in the Caribbean. The French had slaves in the Caribbean. Brazil, of course, had slaves throughout Latin America. There was slavery in the Middle East. There was slavery in the Philippines. There was types of indenture that were like slavery in Southeast Asia. There's slavery today. It's shocking.
Thank you.
Where was your God? Oh, right. Obviously Africa.
I guess Professor Appleby, or maybe perhaps both, were there any particular individuals that stood out, for example, in the generation you studied, or world events that had influence in shaping the way that we are?
Well, the world events that were shaping their youth was, of course, the French Revolution, the rise of Napoleon, the great Napoleonic Wars of Liberation and his defeat, and then the reaction that we associate with the Congress of Vienna in the second decade of the 19th century. My generation did not produce any great figures, either in the arts or in literature, in government. I mean, I can mention Daniel Webster and Henry Clay. Schoolboys used to learn their speeches, but I wouldn't say that they were great figures. So it's not a period of greatness in that sense. And the world events were, after Napoleon is defeated, you kind of have a retreat to a status quo, to shoring up the monarchies of Europe, and it is not a period that's productive of very much excitement.
What was the influence of the War of 1812 on your generation?
Well, the War of 1812 was very important in the sense that it gave, most of all, it gave this generation its own heroes, particularly naval heroes. It was they viewed it as a kind of a second war of independence. But as you know, the War of 1812 was a sort of a series of bungled moves and disasters and loss of Detroit. And it wasn't a glorious war. And when you think about it, the only battle we know about is one that was fought after the peace was signed, that is to say, the Battle of New Orleans in January of 1815. Of course, the British burned most of the buildings in Washington. Interesting that with the War of 1812, which we're just now doing research on, to confirm what the American Revolution confirmed, is that wherever the war went to the South and there was a place for slaves to run away to freedom, to get behind British lines, they took that opportunity. And this, of course, gave the lie to the plantation owners saying that slaves accepted the institution. And in 1812, again, you had happened what happened in the American Revolution. So it was a mixed picture, I think, because it ended well. At least they weren't beat. They were still independent. There was a sense of pride. And as I said, there were these Stephen Decatur and other heroes that were particularly naval heroes. But it fostered manufacturing, all those things that are in that textbook chapter on the War of 1812 that I won't go through. But I would say that really sort of summarized its impact.
Questions on the right here.
If you were to stand up. Professor Appleby, are there any memoirs that you particularly enjoyed that you'd recommend for the literary merit? And then also any that you found to be to reflect a particularly acute understanding of the situation in any sense that you might recognize from your own analysis?
Yes, there were a number. In fact, Mr. Thoreau mentioned a book, The Recollections of the Early Republic. There were so many fine autobiographies in the sense of people who were just excellent writers and just evoked a way of life that I actually put together a book of extracts from 10 of the autobiographies. But I can just, a wonderful woman by the name of Julia Tevis, who had a terrific autobiography. I mean, if you want to come up afterwards, I can give you some of the names. But that book, Recollections of the Early Republic, does have extracts from autobiographies, and they're well worth reading. They're good writers, unheralded writers.
I wanted to ask Professor Appleby, given the dynamism you've mentioned in the North, the education and the population growth in the North, why is it that all the leaders of the general government were from the South? The presidents, most of the presidents before the Civil War were Southerners, as I understand it, except for the two Adamses.
They weren't all, but you're right. I think that part of it is the fact that in the South, it was very much an oral tradition. They were not anywhere near as literate. They were people who were very gifted at persuading others. They had the skills of politicians in this regard. Secondly, slavery was on the defensive, thrown on the defensive so quickly in the New Republic that the South had much less competition for offices. They saw the importance of getting people into Congress and they're getting the seniority that was necessary. The third reason is that the Southerners were members of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party won the presidency every time except for two Whig victories. And the Democratic Party was this peculiar amalgamation of Southerners, almost all Southerners, and then a Northern working men's party, as some entrepreneurs, but it was very definitely the party of the popular party, is the party the Irish immigrants went into. And I think the Southerners were attached to the party that was the most popular for a variety of reasons. I don't know whether that's satisfactory, but I think those three converged to give the South a predominance. And of course, it didn't help them to have that predominance, because I think it made them believe that slavery was not the issue that it was, and led them into a false security about their continued leadership. I think the Civil War was a shock. I think Lincoln's victory was a shock.
For Dr. Eichholz, in your tracking of the concept of self-government through the years, did you arrive at a point where the concept or the idea or the label of home rule suddenly arose? Or was that a label that was placed on the same idea as self-government?
You mean in terms of the independence of a people, autonomy? It depends on which what dictionary you're looking at, of course, but certainly that does that comes in. Are you asking when does it come in? Well, up until, I've got the dictionary entries here. You could take a look at them. But up until the Civil War, up until 1860, actually, the only definition is of self-government is government of oneself, and that's how it's actually expressed. That's in the American context, the other definitions. Well, now let's see. If you look at the second edition of the American Heritage Dictionary, College Edition, you'll see that the political independence that you're referring to of a people, not even necessarily that it's democratic government, it's just that they're independent of anyone else's rule. It's there. You see that as the first definition. The second definition in that dictionary is the democratic definition, and then finally listed as archaic is government of oneself. So now exactly when that comes in or where they've derived that, I'm not exactly certain, but we can look that up.
We have time for one more question. There's one in the way in the back.
Oh,
this gentleman here.
The wedge that you described early on as cutting between North and South, had that wedge moved a little faster or cut deeper, and the Southern states consolidated and confederated earlier, would this generation you're talking about have been more receptive to a separatist or secessionist movement? And if so, if the Civil War had been averted, how do you think that would have affected the elimination of slavery? Would it have been more along the lines of Brazil, or what do you think?
That's a very interesting question. Very interesting, because I'd never thought of it, but I feel quite certain that this generation would have let the South go. I think that the Constitution was just too new, and the idea of a compact of states did have a viability, an intellectual viability, which it begins to lose as people's sympathies are associated with the nation, and the nation becomes a stronger concept. I mean, Calhoun says, "I never use the word nation," and he saw the danger of that word, and he referred to it as the Union. And of course, the Union has a concept, implication of disunion. You can do. So I think they would have let them go, and I think you're right. I think it would have taken longer. As you know, Brazil was very late in abolishing slavery. There probably would have been some replication of the Northern abolition, which was gradual. And there were ideas like that brooded around. At one time, the Northern legislatures actually agreed to a compensated abolition of slavery in the South, and they sent petitions to the Southern legislatures in the 1820s and 30s with this proposition. The South would have nothing to do with it, because by that time it was an infringement of their honor to say that this was a hideous institution that had to be eliminated. They no longer shared that revolutionary commitment which they had of seeing slavery as an evil that ought to be abolished. The new generation of Southerners did not take that, for the most part, that position. So I think that's probably what would have happened. It's very, it's very interesting to reflect on that.
Just one little one thing to add to that. I think Daniel Webster in the War of 1812, when he was a very young, early in his career, representative from New Hampshire, not yet from Massachusetts, invoked a states' rights argument, the implication of which led in that direction, that the North might actually secede from the South. And that's a very interesting idea. But one of the conceptions behind the whole federal structure was that that sort of implied threat was there and gave teeth to the protective mechanism of federalism, that it would check the encroachment of the national government or the whatever powers that were infringing on their state rights.
It's interesting that we ended on that question, since, as I mentioned initially, one of our speakers was going to be Henry Mayer, and about a year ago we held a seminar on the period leading up to the Civil War, and one of our guests here tonight was one of the speakers that worked on that period, and the Civil War addresses these very issues, which is something that I highly recommend. I want to particularly thank our speakers tonight, not only for their presentations, but also for their work in making these books possible and illuminating for us ideas and events that are with us today. Again, those of you who have not gotten a copy of Professor Appleby's book, there are copies upstairs. I'm sure she'd be delighted to autograph copies if you haven't gotten yours autographed yet. And I want to thank our visitors and viewers from C-SPAN 2 for joining with us. We hope to see you again next time. And thank you for joining with us. Good night.